Okay. Let me start with an anecdote. Why don't we turn down the lights for a moment? The picture here is a reproduction of a picture that was found in an album of photos that Wittgenstein carried around all of his life. So the philosopher Wittgenstein had pictures in this book. They were pictures of people, close friends, David Pinsent, John Maynard Keynes, Gene Moore, and philosophers who he admired, and especially family members, his father, mother, brothers and sisters, aunts and uncles. And then the very last picture in the book was this picture. Apparently a picture of a woman. I sent this picture to Richard Searle a few days ago to ask him to reproduce it. I asked if he got it, and he said, yes, I got the picture of the woman. As if you just look at this, looks like a picture of a woman. And then the question was, who is this? Kind of look like it might, it really looks like a member of the Wittgenstein family. And you have actually the pictures of the others, brothers and sisters, right there in the album. I didn't give them to you, but they're right there. And it looks like one more of them. But the only problem was there were pictures of all the other four sisters. There is no fifth sister. And this sister didn't seem to be identical. So maybe an aunt or an uncle. Well, probably an aunt. Which aunt? Nobody could figure it out. Then finally, people started looking at the picture more carefully. A first clue is if you look, you'll notice some things are darker than others. So there's a necklace, another necklace, almost see a third necklace. Why is it so much lighter? Start looking at the clothes. How many garments of clothing is she wearing? One, looks like there's something under here. Two, three, it looks like this is a fourth. Is that a fifth, a sixth, a seventh, an eight? Garments of clothing? Must have been a cold day. But it doesn't seem that bulky. And then they started looking at the other pictures, and they noticed, well, in the picture of Wittgenstein, he seems to be wearing a jacket that looks just like that. And one of them's wearing a necklace with two beads, and one's wearing a necklace with one bead, and one's wearing a V. And it wasn't by looking at the face, but actually looking at the clothes down here. They started realizing, this picture somehow contains the pictures of the other four siblings, the four sisters, and the picture of Wittgenstein that preceded it in the album. This is what is called a composite photograph. So one of the things I'm going to be talking about today is composite photography. This particular composite photograph is one Wittgenstein made of himself and his sisters. Four women, one man. Hence, it looks like a woman. This is a very fine composite photograph. It's quite a bit of work to make such a thing. Roughly speaking, the way Wittgenstein, there's many different techniques. This isn't the technique that Galton used, so I'll be talking about. But Wittgenstein used another technique, which involves having five people sit in front of a camera. So say you're using a photographic plate, these are old cameras, that requires a 60-second exposure to get a really crisp picture. Each of them sat in front of the camera and it was exposed for 12 seconds. So all five cases together gives you the quantity of time that you require for an optimal exposure. But the camera is being exposed to five different faces. That's not enough. They all had to sit in a chair. You can't see it, but behind them there are pegs holding their head in a certain position to make sure, in particular, the eyes and the nose are perfectly aligned. Those are the axis on which all of the faces are being superimposed. The way Galton tended to do it was to take pictures, then to alter the pictures, and then to align them, and then to take photographs of the photographs. It's easier to control than with the people. You acquire more equipment. Wittgenstein actually just had the five people sit in a certain design chair. But one point is, it's a lot of work. He went to this work, although he's a philosopher, not a photographer, because there's something that interested him about such photographs. And so part of what we want to know is what interested him. His interest in composite photography came in the first instance from his reading Galton. Sir Francis Galton is the person who really perfected, in some sense invented, and also realized part of the intellectual, philosophical significance of this technique. Maybe we'll just go to the next picture for a moment. The next picture is an example of a composite photograph that Galton made. This here is the composite made from these pictures. So these are all individual portraits of these people. These are all physicians at Harvard University. They're not members of a family. That's a composite of what? The ideal doctor? The ideal Harvard professor? The ideal Harvard medical professor? What that's a picture of is something we will come to. But Galton's thought was, by arranging these things in this way, that if you look at this picture, you should be able to see the features of each of these people in that picture. That's one thing you should be able to do, without any single one predominating, if it's done properly. And he thought many other things about the significance of these pictures. And so, let's go back to the first picture. So the aim of today's talk is, in a sense, fairly modest. What I hope to do today is at least the following: to convince you that such pictures are philosophically interesting. Why you might find them philosophically interesting, exactly what we should conclude from them, I think, are actually rather difficult questions. I won't attempt to answer them in the talk, but we might take them up in the discussion. And I'm hoping, I'm as looking forward to the discussion as much as the talk. I'm hoping to stimulate you to think about these things. One very straightforward question we might ask, just as a way of bringing out a certain kind of philosophical perplexity these pictures can occasion, is the following. What is this a picture of? It's a picture. If you think it's a photograph, what is it a photograph of? Well, the first thing you say, as we already know, if you look at it, is it's a photograph of a woman. But there is no particular woman who is the woman which this photograph is a picture of. So if we think of photographs as some sense caused by an individual that stands in front of the camera, there is no such particular. But then how are we going to understand what it's a picture of? That how you want to answer that question itself will depend upon your other philosophical commitments. So now what I'm going to do next, we can have the lights back, is talk first about John Locke, Immanuel Kant, and Johann Wolfgang Goethe. And what I'm going to suggest to you is each of them had a reason for being interested in composite photography. None of them knew about it. It wasn't invented until the second half of the 19th century and on. But they each had a reason for being interested in it. And then I'm going to try to show you that Galton's own reasons were in some ways connected with theirs, and that Wittgenstein's reasons for being interested in it is because reflection on composite photography can bring out both a kind of a truth and a kind of a limitation in the ideas of each of these thinkers. Locke here is really standing in as the classical empiricist. And what I'm interested in here is, first of all, a question Locke asks. He asks, how did general words come to be made? This is the first quotation on your handout of quotations. How did general words come to be made? Locke makes a faithful step here. He's trying to understand what concepts are. But one of the things that Locke assumes is that the following two questions are ways of asking the same question. First question, what are concepts, or general ideas, or general terms? And how do we come to have concepts, or general ideas? Or by what process do we acquire and learn general words, make them? Locke assumes those two questions are the same question. Answering one gives you an answer to the other. And that is a very tempting thing to think in philosophy, even if you don't agree with the details of Locke's answer. That assumption itself is part of what Wittgenstein will be examining later. Locke gives a very famous answer to this question. He gives something which he calls the theory of abstraction. And so this is really an answer to both of these questions at once. What is the process by which we acquire general terms, come to learn concepts? By abstracting. But it also, at the same time, gives you an answer to the question, what are concepts? Or what do general terms stand for? Answer, abstract ideas. Where what it is to say something's an abstract idea has a very specific philosophical content loaded into it in virtue of this theory of how they're acquired. How does abstraction work? Abstraction works by our abstracting out everything that is particular to the circumstances of the time and place and so forth, we let things fall away. By this process of abstraction, he says, we're capable of representing more individuals than one. So Locke's thought is, our initial ideas are simple ideas. They are particulars. I see somebody, I give it a name. Maybe I call it Richard. That's just the name of something particular. Kato, I've got two particular ideas. Gunnar, I've got three particular ideas. I'm not going to get very far as a thinker if I only have ideas like that. I only have words that, as it were, function as properness. So I need to arrive at something more general. I do this by abstracting from the particulars. And one feature of Locke's theory that's worth making explicit, Locke makes this explicit. People repress this by thinking it's only with some such conception that the theory of abstraction fully makes sense. These initial simple ideas are themselves pictures, Locke says, or at least like pictures. What I do when I form my initial ideas is I have a picture of this individual, a picture of that individual, a picture of that individual. Well, where? Does it mean if you open up my head, you'll find a picture? No, well, they will say it's a mental picture. But some thought still is that its representational capacity, vis-a-vis the individual it represents, is to be understood on the model of how a picture represents a thing it represents. How is that? Well, we're told resemblance. The picture resembles, in some sense, copies the pictures of the thing. It's a good picture. It contains all the determinacy and detail the thing itself does. Then if we want general ideas, we need to leave those out, all of that detail. So the thought is, the baby's first word might be something like mama. What does mama mean? Well, it means a particular idea. What is a particular idea? In the first instance, it's something like a mental picture of mama. But now we want to go on and say, form a concept of a mother. Maybe even eventually a woman. Maybe even eventually the concept of a person. So, in doing this, Locke says, general ideas make nothing new, quotation four, but they only leave out what is peculiar. So you might say that Locke's theory of abstraction is, in a certain sense, really a theory of subtraction. What we do is, we collect such pictures, and we see what the different pictures have in common. And we leave out that which they don't have in common, and that which the pictures do have in common. Slide 2 might be relevant here. So you can see how composite photography might seem to be a literalization of Locke's theory of the acquisition of general ideas. And one of the things that interested Galton about it was exactly some such thought, that he was slowing down the mental processes by which we form general ideas. We have this particular idea. We have this particular idea. Sorry. There's a particular idea. George, or maybe better, Professor Palmer, Professor Smith, Professor Jones, Professor Thompson. We have our particular ideas. Now we form a general idea of that which they all have in common. Maybe it looks like that. This is taking Locke more literally, perhaps, than Locke meant it. But you can see how there is a kind of fantasy of something like composite photography as a mental mechanism in the theory of abstraction itself, as a route by which we form general ideas. It's funny how close Locke comes to describing things that Galton actually does. We're talking about individuals. The end of quotation 4, he says, well, you have a complex idea. Complex here means it contains a lot of detail of Peter, and a complex idea of James, a complex idea of Mary and of Jane. And then when we form the new abstract idea that is of what they all have in common, say those four siblings, Wittgenstein's siblings, had been named Peter, James, Mary, and Jane, then what we're forming is an idea of what they have that's common to all. So you could see this, if you take this to be names of siblings, as something like a description of what's happening in that composite photograph. And as quotation 5 makes clear, Locke thinks, and so on, up the ladder of generality, more general ideas, even the most general ones, like substance, which he thinks is a fairly empty idea, well, you can see why he's bound to think that, are formed by leaving out more and more of the detail that we start with when our initial, incredibly rich, complex ideas. So there is this idea that we do this process of abstraction by focusing on what is common to each of the pictures, the individual ideas, or by leaving in only wherein they are found to agree, as he puts at the end of quotation 6. And you might ask, how do you do that? Can you do that while making nothing new? This takes us to Kant. One of Kant's basic criticisms of the empiricists is, you can't find that wherein things agree without already bringing a concept to your experience. If I show you any two things and I ask you, are they the same or not? Are they the same? Well, in many respects, they're the same. They're both man-made, they're both weigh under 10 pounds, they both fit in my pocket, they both belong to me, I both bought them at the same time because one came in the other. And in many respects, they're different. I need a concept, sameness with respect to what, in order to determine a dimension of resemblance. Resemblance isn't something I can just pick out of individuals in virtue of the individuals they are. So Kant will say, no, we can't arrive at concepts by making nothing new. Rather, we have perceptions of things falling under concepts because we first make the concepts and bring them to experience. Concepts are, if you will, exercises of our faculty of spontaneity, as Kant puts it. You can bring out the problem here for Locke in a very straightforward way. Consider the following concepts: father, son, brother, uncle. Picture of Richard, picture of Kanto, picture of Gunnar. How am I going to iterate these pictures, leaving out what they don't have in common, only taking what they have in common, and closing in on brother, uncle, father, one of those concepts instead of the other? In the average population, many people are brothers and uncles and fathers and sons. Very hard to be a son without having a father, and so forth. So these individuals can all be sorted under those concepts. It isn't as if pictures of them, iterated, will, as it were, give you a picture of the one rather than the other. Those principles of sorting themselves have to come from our first fashioning concepts, in accordance with which things are grouped. So Kant will distinguish between what he takes to be two fundamentally different kinds of representations, which Kant will call intuitions and concepts. Intuitions, Kant will say, are singular and immediate. They are exercises of our faculty of passivity. They have some of what Locke's impressions had. We experience them by sensing, and they are particulars. But part of Locke's point is, part of Kant's point is, against somebody like Locke or Hume, is you can't have an impression of a mother or even mama without first having also a concept that singular representation is related to. To experience something as mama is to be capable of judging, this is mama, which is to bring that particular under a concept. It presupposes a judgment. And that judgment involves more than the apprehension of a singular particular passively taken in. So we do need singular immediate representations like intuitions. But we also need concepts. Concepts, Kant says, are general and mediated. We never immediately perceive a concept. Concepts are always, as Kant puts it, representations of representations. They're always concerned with what things have in common. And they are, therefore always have a kind of generality built into them. Even if there's only one of them, even if there's none of them, you know, the concept, people in this room over 7 feet, has the extension of zero. There are no such people. But it's still general, because we can ask, how many are there? That question is well formed. So the question is, what makes it general is not, is there zero or is there one? But is it the kind of thing which allows for the question, what is the generality of this, the extension of this representation? Now, Kant's going to say, against the empiricist, that you can't really have cognition unless you have both. So he famously says, intuitions without concepts are blind. Singular, immediate representations wouldn't be a kind of representation. They wouldn't pick out an individual. They'd be blind, unless they also came together with concepts that would allow us to sort them. And similarly, he'll say, concepts are empty. They wouldn't have any content unless there were things that were could in principle be sorted by them. Now, there are two issues that come up in Kant that are going to be important for the subsequent story I'm going to tell. You might think of them as two kinds of problems that come up in Kant's philosophy. The first comes up in what became a very notorious set of pages that Kant wrote, namely section 77 of the Critique of Judgment. These pages were of tremendous interest to subsequent German philosophy, in the sense in which you can say much of subsequent German philosophy came out of those pages. Section 77 are pages from early in the second half of the Third Critique, the part called, the Third Critique is the Critique of Judgment. They come from the part called the Critique of Teleological Judgment. Kant's there trying to understand how we represent features of nature, where our understanding of the parts seem to presuppose a prior understanding of a certain kind of whole. So understanding a certain kind of organism, an animal or a plant, seems to first involve understanding as a whole what kind of form it is and what kind of purposes it has. So to take a simple kind of example, we can make a statement like this. Horses have four legs, or the horse is four-legged. When I say that, I'm not engaging in empirical generalization. Show me a horse, it will always have four legs. You show me a three-legged horse, there are some. I'm not going to think, oops. You know, horses have 3.97 legs. Got it wrong. That's not the right thing to say. The answer is simple. We have a conception, as it were, what a healthy, thriving horse is, what the form of a horse is, such that a three-legged horse is not a counterexample to the claim that horses have four legs. Our understanding of what that three-legged horse is an expression of a life form that, properly understand, is, you know, in its ideality, is four-legged. You know, similarly with all sorts of other respects. You know, in the summer, birds fly south. Yeah, some bird, there's some crazy little bird will head off the wrong way. What we want to understand is why that bird did that. We don't want to alter our generalization about birds. So we understand these life forms, their understanding of the kind of whole they are. And the individuals that make up that whole are then understood relative to the whole. But how could that be? Kant thinks that requires our sort of mimicking a kind of understanding by first coming up with mechanical explanations that then mimic what these intentional explanations of the life forms seem to characterize. Because he thinks that, strictly speaking, our understanding of wholes always has to be understood as reciprocally related to an understanding of the parts. This is connected with his thinking that sensibility and understanding are distinct kinds of exercises that have to work a certain kind of way. Kant contrasts in section 77 of the Third Critique our understanding with another possible type of understanding, which he says there's no logical contradiction in, and we can form it to see how ours is different from that. That would be what he calls an archetypal understanding. We can conceive of such an understanding, he says, in this quotation 3 under Kant, which, since it is not discursive like ours, but is intuitive, involves such an intuition of the whole as such. That would require that we had an immediate apprehension of generality, that we could intuitively apprehend a whole We could see something that has the character of concepts through the exercise of something like a faculty of intuition. That's exactly what Kant's distinction of two fundamental kinds of representation does not allow for. Because we finite beings, he thinks, must always first apprehend that which is outside of us, which always requires a sensibility which then involves a further reflective act on the part of the understanding before generality enters into the form of thought and apprehension we are capable of. So that's the first issue that comes up in Kant. A second one comes up in quotation 4. This is a passage in Kant that comes up just before what's called the schematism in the first critique. And what Kant realizes there is a very important problem which is still at the heart of contemporary philosophy. Some people think Wittgenstein, with his rule-following considerations, discovered this problem, but it's already in the first critique. What Kant realizes is, if we think of concepts as something like rules, and we think of the understanding as the faculty of rules, the faculty that gives us these concepts, and we think of judgment as the faculty that subsumes particulars under these concepts, and we think of judgment as it's itself something like the applying of rules, then a regress looms. That it looks like in order to bring an individual under a concept, I myself first need a rule which tells me how to do that. But then I need to understand that rule and bring that case under the concept of that rule, which in turn requires, and we're off on a regress. So it looks like judgment, Kant thinks, there has to be some way to make sense of it. The judgment is a kind of primitive faculty in which we can apprehend individuals and we can have concepts and see that they apply. But the application of the concepts cannot itself be mediated in terms of an account that tells you why you apply that concept into further concepts. This is a further critique of the molecularism of empiricism. It's very tempting to think, how do you know something is a brother? Well, because it's a male sibling. How do you know it's a sibling? Well, because it's the little kid. Well, but at some point, you know, answers are going to run out. You know, how are you going to know that? If you keep having to break concepts down into the sub-necessary and sufficient conditions that you allow you to apply them, then you're going to need the necessary and sufficient conditions for applying the concepts that express those conditions. So Kant thinks, no, judgment has to be something else. This comes, and one of the things that Kant insists on is that the refinement and cultivation of the capacity of judgments requires a kind of encounter with examples that cannot itself be understood simply in terms of the further application of concepts. Examples, as he puts it in quotation 5, are the go-kart of judgment. They are the thing that allow us to sharpen this faculty. And Kant, in this passage, contrasts people who are wonderfully theoretically sophisticated about the nature of the kind of physics or whatever that's involved in a certain kind of activity. I can imagine a certain kind of professor of bicycling that can tell you exactly what Lance Armstrong is actually doing in order to be able to climb that hill, and the character of the equilibrium, and what he's doing with his body fluids, and what kind of soft breathing is required. He might really have figured this all out. But who do you want on the bicycle in the Tour de France? You probably want Lance Armstrong and not that professor. Even though Lance couldn't tell you any of this. So a reflective understanding of what the conditions are under which certain concepts should be applied and the actual practical ability to realize those concepts in a particular situation are not themselves to be confused. This comes in the schematism chapter because Kant's trying to understand how do we, in the most fundamental case, bring our most basic concepts to experience. And Kant thinks something further must be required. Schemata, he says. And the concepts of explaining what schemata are, he's clearly having difficulty putting this into words, and he thinks there's a reason for that. But one of the things he says about schemata is we might think of them as a kind of monogram. Monogram was a German art historical term in the 18th century for something that happened in a certain stage of painting. If a painter was painting a fresco inside of a cathedral, first you put up a monogram, that is, you put up a kind of chalk sketch of the painting. The blue goes here, the red goes here, and so forth. But first you sketched it out, then you put in the full color. So that's a kind of analogy or metaphor that's supposed to be suggestive of how schemata stand to concepts. Goethe comes along, and he thinks, there's much I like in Kant, but what Goethe thinks is there must be some way that we ourselves are capable of this thing that Kant says finite discursive beings cannot do. Goethe's not trying to say we're infinite divine beings, but he is trying to say that it must be possible, and he thinks this that for reasons that come from thinking about the same sciences that got Kant going on this subject, botany, ethology, sciences about living forms, but he thinks it has a more general application. It must be possible for us to intuitively apprehend unity. For it can't be that our only relation to a kind of generality or unity in an individual is the bringing of it under a discursive concept that we ourselves are bringing to experience. And there's a famous story, which you get in your first quotation here from Goethe, which is an encounter he had with Schiller, where they're both coming for botany lectures. This is when Goethe and Schiller first met and became friends. Schiller was a dyed-in-the-wool Kantian at this point. And Goethe is trying to explain his ideas to him. He tries to draw him a little picture of the fundamental form of the plant. He doesn't think you can actually represent this in a picture, but he thinks you can cause people, as it were, have an apprehension of the kind of character something has to have in order so much as be a plant, which itself can't be expressed in any concept. And they reach a certain point, and then Schiller says, in this quotation, but that is not an observation from experience. That is an idea. Kant's already explained all of that. This is general, it's therefore immediate, it's a kind of concept or idea. Taken aback and somewhat annoyed, I paused. With this comment, he had touched on the very point that divided us. I collected my wits and replied, that I may rejoice that I have ideas without knowing it, and can even see them with my very eyes. So we might put Goethe's, from a Kantian point of view, slightly crazy thought by saying, it must be possible to see a concept, to see something general with one's eye, simply in virtue of looking. In quotation 2, you have Goethe's take on what's right and what's wrong in Kant's famous section 77. He thinks, well, yes, there's something we finite things cannot do, but there also must be something that's being characterized here. A kind of... And he thinks that he sees Kant here as almost, he almost wonders whether Kant's ironic. He's driving us to a kind of despair by describing this possibility and saying, we cannot have it, thereby actually posing the fundamental philosophical problem rather than solving it. In the interest of time, I think I'll skip everything else I said about, was going to say about Goethe, and just pause for a moment to now think about where we are with Locke, Kant, and Goethe. So Locke has a reason to be interested in composite photographs. Namely, they seem to offer us a kind of slow-motion application of how we arrive at abstract ideas, according to his theory of abstraction. Kant has a very different kind of reason why he might be interested in this. And a later Kantian, namely Charles Sanders Peirce, we'll see is explicitly interested in composite photographs for this reason. Namely, that they offer us possibly a way of refining our thinking about what a monogram or a schema, which we bring to experience, as a condition of being able to organize things under a concept without yet applying a concept, might be. And Goethe has a third and rather different reason for possibly being interested in composite photographs, based on the line of thought that comes out of section 77 of the Third Critique. Namely, whether you could have a representation, think about what Goethe wants to say, and think about composite photographs, whether you could have a representation which is of something which for all the world appears to be the representation of a particular. But in apprehending that particular, you apprehend something that has a certain kind of general application to other instances. You're intuitively representing through a certain kind of relation, something that has the character of a particular generality, without yet bringing a concept. Which concept do you want to bring, if you want to bring a concept to this? You don't yet know. So they each have a reason to be interested in composite photography. Now let's look at how Galton, who's really the father of this technique, arrived at it. One line of thought we have in Galton, which you find in quotation one, is just being struck by just in itself what an amazing feat it is that human beings can recognize faces. If you're in an enormous crowd with many people, you can pick out somebody you know like that. And he pauses to think about that and realize that's quite amazing. From a certain kind of general distance, you might think faces all look sort of similar. You know, the eyes are here, the nose is here, the mouth is here. From some point of view, you know, faces aren't that much more like or unlike each other than blades of grass, which you're not that good at telling apart. But we are tremendously good at this. So there's a tremendous complexity here. And part of what interests him is he thinks the kind of complexity which allows us this recognition, and he tries to show this partly through composite photography, is too minute to measure. Because one of the things, a further thing about faces, if you take pictures of them, is a face in some sense always looks different. It's also capable of many different expressions. So you're always seeing these, as it were, manifestations of this face as all expressions of that particular face distinguishing it from others. Where the general expression of a face, as he puts it in the middle of your first quotation, is the sum of a multitude of small details, which are viewed in such rapid succession that we seem to perceive them all at a single glance. So there's a complexity, it's too minute to measure, and yet at the same time, the apprehension of this complexity seems to take place instantaneously. It's not as if what I do is stare and work it out and go, you know, that has all of the features of Kanto's face. Kanto! I just see it as Kanto in a glance. So the complexity, the apparent ephemeralness, unmeasurability, and yet instantaneous apprehensibility is crucial to a kind of problem that underlies sensory cognition, underlies perception. And faces seem to be a particularly extreme example of. So one of his reasons for being interested in this. Galton tries to bring this out in the second quotation by saying, imagine what a portrait painter does. And he actually sits and, being Galton, watches a portrait painter and counts each time he puts his brush to the canvas and works out that 24,000 separate strokes were required in the sitting he was watching. If on average he did this as often as he seemed to. From which he says, roughly, it's a rough quantification, but let's just have a way of starting. That suggests something like 24,000 separate traits are captured in the completed portrait. And he wants to suggest there's a comparably large number of units of resemblance in the original. So it's a way, what everyone thinks of the explicit quantification here in terms of 24,000, of trying to bring out the actual complexity of what it is the eye is taking in. When it looks at the portrait, it says, oh, that's a fine portrait of Kanto. The kind of complexity that has to be built into that by a painter in order for it to appear that way, rather than not such a good portrait or a who's that sort of a picture. It's the kind I draw. Another problem that he's up against is then he's wondering about what is the typical face. He actually has a bet where he and a friend sit on a bridge, in quotation three, and try to wait till the typical John Bull, the typical Englishman, walk by. So you can pick him out first. And they wait all day. And they never pick anyone. How could it be that no Englishman looks like the typical Englishman? And yet they're all, many of them are recognized. They can separate them out from the Chinese and so forth. These are times when racial pronouncements in London are somewhat more extreme. They can tell these are all Englishmen. And yet, none of them seems to represent an ideal case. So he says, in quotation four, it was a means of procuring really representative faces that he contrived this method of composite portraiture to get the really representative or the really typical face. So this suggests an answer to the question, what's that a picture of? It's a picture of a certain kind of typical face. initially typical physician, perhaps. But that's only one of Galton's motivations. In fact, it would take quite a bit of time to fully describe all of Galton's projects. He was both a genius and a nut. Other reasons he has for wanting to do this are very practical. One of the things he hopes to come out of this is the identification of disease. You can start to tell when somebody, say, has syphilis by being able to recognize the characteristic expressions or physiognomic expressions. The identification of criminals. He's hoping to get representations of the typical face of the criminal. Boy, that would be helpful. You might think that's crazy, but Galton actually, in this same project, thought of another way to identify criminals, namely fingerprinting, which, for all of the disrespect that he's fallen into because some of his more eugenic ideas, that disrespect didn't come till the 30s when the Nazis adopted his ideas. And at that point, fingerprinting was so important to the police all over the world that although they threw out composite photography for the most part, no one was about to get rid of fingerprinting. So the funny thing about Galton is some very important things came out of his research. Remember, there's no time to talk about all of them. But identification of types. And then finally, another thing I'll talk about briefly is part of what he's interested in. He's also one of the fathers of modern statistics. He's a very good mathematician. And one of the things he's interested in is the pictorial representation of statistical significance. I'll say something about how he thinks composite photography is root to that in a moment. Quotation 5, you have something I'm not going to discuss, but I just thought I owed it to you, was at least one description of how these composite photographs are made. This is actually Galton's simplest method of doing this, which he immediately abandons in favor of methods that work better but are even more complicated to explain. If you're interested in exactly how these things are made, we can talk about it, but I didn't want to leave it a complete mystery. Now, what is the effect of composite portraiture? Galton says in quotation 6, it's to bring into evidence all the traits in which there is agreement and to leave but a ghost of a trace of individual peculiarities. So the things that people have in common, it's useful here to think about this person's, I don't think Galton cared about this, but it brings out the point nicely. Think about this person's facial hair. This person's facial, if I can speak of this person in this case, if you'll forgive the singular reference in talking about the composite. This person's facial hair, you might think of as representing a kind of pictorial, statistical average of the kinds of facial hair we have here. How far this guy's got an enormous beard. He's the only guy who has that, so that's mostly gone. We have a lot of mustaches, so we have this part of the mustache is most pronounced. If you think of the darkness of the hair as itself representing the frequency of hair occurrence. Now, facial hair is something you can just shave off, so I don't think Galton would be very happy with my focusing on this. But it brings out something he's interested in with respect to the other parts of the face, particularly clearly, which is when you make a composite, you're only going to get a ghost of the traces of the things that are statistically fairly eccentric. And you're going to get a highlighting of the features that are statistically frequent. There are so many traits in common in all faces that a composite picture, when made from many components, is far from being a blur. And here comes a phrase that's something that Galton struggles with what to make of. It has the look of an ideal composition. It doesn't just have the character of being a certain kind of statistically average, but it has the aspect of a kind of ideality. We'll come back to this. Something that would have interested Goethe. But Galton's not sure what to make of it, I think, really. But he's honest about it. He says, one of the things he points out about these composite portraits that we already noticed in the story of the Wittgenstein picture in the album is that these faces have a surprising air of reality. You make a composite, well, it looks like a picture of somebody. He says, nobody who glanced at one of them for the first time without a doubt, it's being the likeness of a living person. Yet, it is no such thing. And then Galton says, it's a portrait of a type, not individual. So Galton wants to say, whenever we make a composite, it's a portrait of a type. How does he know that? What kind of claim is that? Here he started with physicians. Staway just started with random pictures of people of all different kinds. Black, white, big, little, doctors and lawyers, rich and poor, employed and unemployed, happy and sad, old and young. 17 of them. We made a composite. What type would that be a picture of? He started with physicians. So he's already, as it were, applying a concept and telling us what this type, this picture is a picture of a type of. We want this as a theory of how we arrive at types. How will that work? Those who see composite portraits for the first time, he says, can hardly believe that one dominant face, but that one dominant face has overpowered the rest. And Galton has all sorts of little tests for convincing them this isn't true. One of the things he points out, when you have a composite, this is only about 16, when you have a composite made of many pictures, one of the things you can do is take out the one that they think dominates. And the resulting composite still looks almost the same as exactly the way the first one did. Which means that the significance of that initial face that seemed to dominate isn't that it's dominant, but that it seems to correspond to this person's conception of what ideal is being represented in the composite picture. Why don't we look at a few more examples of how he arrives at these kinds of composites. These are the next slide is of these same physicians when they're older. He goes back 20 years later, takes pictures of the same individual, and gets this picture. So what are we? There's all kinds of things we can say we might be studying now. Something about physicians, something about aging, something about how physicians age as a class. Next picture, the next two pictures, in fact, are different regiments of soldiers. These are Saxon soldiers. These are soldiers. The next one is soldiers from the province of Vend. So these are two different regiments of German soldiers. So is the idea that the first one is a generic representation of a Saxon soldier? Second one, a generic representation of a Vend soldier? What if somebody was transferred from one regiment to another? I purposely picked examples where, although Galton has made these pictures, they're very nice composites, and it does look like a picture of somebody. What exactly the significance of the composites are supposed to be in these cases is not easy to say. Another problem that Galton has is when he's really doing lots of these, say the two cases I particularly mentioned he was interested in, the criminal and certain kinds of diseases like syphilis, he noticed that some pictures don't form a gestalt composite as nicely as others. The reason it's great to do members of a family is because they look like each other. That's why you can get such an uncanny final result when you superimpose them. So he has a tendency to sort them into types. Let's look at the next two slides. So he was getting this, as he did a lot of composites of the criminal, he was getting this thing that wasn't really working for him. I'll say why it wasn't working a little later. So what he does is he separates criminals into different types. And then you get these nice, you know, fairly, you know, things that start looking like mugshots again, instead of running into the problem, which I will call the Lord Byron problem. And I'll tell you why I call it that in a moment. He wants these guys to look like criminals if the cops are going to use this. So he decides maybe there's four types of criminals. This one is made from five composites, that from seven, and so forth. But what's the principle under which we sort the different photographs into types before we make the composite? How do we understand that? Next slide, you have the same thing with two cases of syphilitic people. He divides these into five of this type and 10 in this type. And he gets two nice composites of a sort that it might involve symptoms a doctor could look for. Whereas if he just did all 15, he wasn't as happy with his result. Finally, let's look at the next slide. This is a picture from one of his books. But I'm just going to look at what he says about this case, about the two sisters. One of the things that strikes him about these sorts of cases is the way in which he wants to say the representation is really not of an individual. So with these two sisters, as you'll see from the quotation in the second half of 8, what he does is he sends them to the parents These are very small here, I'm sorry, but imagine they're blown up and a little sharper. He sends them to the parents, and the parents have the following experience. Actually, the father relates to Galton. And he's looking at the picture, and the mother comes in and says, "Oh, what a nice picture of A. I never noticed that A looks so much like B. Or is it a picture of B? That's B. No, it's A." It just couldn't figure out which of her, and then this is the tremendous sort of confusion the mother felt, and not being able to say which her daughters it was. And also feeling somehow that it showed that they looked like each other. Or she couldn't think the picture could be of either of them. But she never had previously thought her daughters looked that similar, so they never had trouble telling them apart. And then a third member, a friend of the family, comes along and says, "Oh, this must be a member of the family. Clearly not A or B, but who is this? I didn't, is there something I don't know?" So this interests Galton tremendously, the way in which there's a perception of this as an individual, and yet no possibility of mistaking it with the individuals who have whose pictures have gone into the making of the composite, but nonetheless a very powerful perception of an affinity with those individuals, all at the same time, simply through the contemplation of a single representation. That would have interested Goethe. Now, Galton points out some amusing things. One thing he points out is that such pictures tend to be very unpopular with the people who seek for them. He said, "Look at this interesting composite I made of you and your brother and your sister." And Galton noticed that people tended to hate these things. They didn't tend to react with gratitude. "We're all inclined," as he puts in quotation 9, "to assert our individuality and to object being mixed up indiscriminately with others." Now, how does Galton understand what composites are? He has a lot of ways of talking about them. One of the things that's nice about him is the sort of openness with which he tries to reflect on this. I think many of the different things he says are actually quite mutually contradictory. At least it's not clear you can say all of these things at once, thinking of these representations the same way at the same time. One thing he wants to say, very reminiscent of Locke, is that a composite is a generalized picture. The mechanical process by means of which we construct these pictures is itself something like a process of generalization. That involves both a philosophical assumption about what generality is, how to understand the distinction between particularity and generality, and a further philosophical assumption that you could do something like render that process mechanical, which he thinks he's done here. That's one way of thinking about it. What I think Wittgenstein is going to say, in fact, as we'll see in a moment, is the opposite. That part of the interest of Galton's application of composite photography in this area is that it gives us a reductio ad absurdum of the empiricist theory of ideas. That if we try to take literally the theory that what generality is abstraction of that sort, then we see why the idea ends in emptiness. So it's exactly the opposite interest in it that Galton has. That's only one of Galton's ways of thinking about it. A second way Galton has of talking is to say a composite represents an averaged figure. This goes back to what I was saying when I was pointing out those lines to you. Maybe we go back to picture 1 for a moment. He says, "The band will be darkest wherever the component portraits have the same general types of feature, and its amount or breadth of blur will measure the tendency of the components to deviate from the common type." So the thought is here something like, if you looked at the individual Wittgenstein pictures, the here where the eyebrows are darkest are where all of their eyebrows overlap. And you can start to see, in fact, it's a little bit funny that it's so light here. That looks more like a painting than a photograph. But that has said something about where there's overlap and where there isn't. We start to become more interested in the fact that the mouth is so dark here. That, again, looks a little more like a particular kind of lighting in the photo. We initially just apprehend it as a photograph. But we can look at this, especially if it's made of 100 pictures, say, superimposed of criminals. There were examples of that in that slide we had a moment ago. Then, one way of looking at this is as a kind of statistical diagram. Wherever you have something that's absolutely dark, you have a very high level of frequency. There where you see nothing, It's not that you have nothing, but you have, all you can say is you have a low level of frequency. Where you have a tendency to blur off, you have the averaging away from the median. But notice, actually, this involves the first thing. It's a generalized picture. And the second thing, it represents an average figure. Actually involves very different ways of looking at the picture. That is, a very different way of understanding how this, as it were, set of marks on a page symbolize. In the one way, we're taking it to be a representation of an individual, in the way we take a photograph to be a representation of an individual. How that works is rather complicated, I think. People say resemblance. Resemblance, I think, is actually just a word for a problem in philosophy here. But at any rate, it is a kind of relation in which this is a picture of a particular thing, and we understand its parts by understanding what a particular thing is. The second way of looking at the picture, which is easier to do, the more repetitions, that is, the more obviously peculiar the composite is. Second way of looking at it, we're looking at a set of marks that are measures of statistical frequency. We're no longer seeing this as a picture of an individual, but we're seeing this as something that measures properties of a whole population of individuals. What would it be to combine those two ways of looking at a picture at once? I think Galton actually equivocates on these two different ways of understanding the diagram and tries to say they're properties of a single mode of representation understood in a single way. It's connected to another confusion that Wittgenstein's interested in, that he thinks composite photography helps make explicit. Let me take you to the problem about the composites of criminals. So this is now the second to last picture. It's the very last picture, second to last picture for you. That's right. Very last picture, I think, in your packet of pictures, if you want to go back and look at any of these things. Here is what a picture of a criminal looks like if you do 1,000 composites. And the more you do, the more it sort of tends in this direction. What Galton notices is, as you iterate the process, you start getting, it doesn't matter who you start with and what kind of person you start with, criminals or princes, you get more and more idealized pictures. Everything starts looking like a sort of romantic portrait of Lord Byron once you start taking too many composites of the individual. What we wanted was initially something that caught the essence of the criminal. But it always seemed to, as it were, converge on a certain kind of genre of artistic representation that is tied to a kind of idealizing tendency in our representation of individuals. As he puts at the bottom of quotation 14, all composites are better looking than their components, because the average portrait of many persons is free from the irregularities that variously blemish the looks at each of them. But that gets even worse as we go to the extreme. So one of the things that happens is that as we iterate the process of composition, compositionality does not lead to our distinguishing different concepts with sharper and sharper boundaries. Rather, it leads to something becoming more and more faded and more idealized. We don't seem to have a recipe here for multiplying and sharpening concepts. We're doing something else. And this just helps bring out something. This comes up in the second of the Wittgenstein quotations, the end of your handout. No, first of the Wittgenstein quotations, the end of your handout, the one from the Blue Book. Something that Wittgenstein finds very helpful about Galton's work and bring out a kind of confusion that he thinks runs throughout the history of philosophy and thinking about the activity of conceptualization. Namely, a conflation between the distinction between that which is particular and that which is general, and that which is specific and that which is generic. That those two distinctions get conflated into a single distinction. The relationship between concepts and individuals, that notion of universality, requires that the concepts really have sharp boundaries. Whether something is a mother, or a sister, or a daughter. And you're not going to be able to get those sharp boundaries through the iteration of impressions and just trying to see how they overlap. On the contrary. But that opposition is different from another one, which is that something can have, as it were, a schematic character. But that kind of schematic character that things have, when we bring out the way in which there's a certain kind of interminacy in the character of the immediately sensory representation. Indeterminacy in sensory representation is not the same thing as generality. If you look out the window at a lawn, I'll ask you, what do you see? I see a lawn. What's a lawn? Well, it's many blades of grass. But the lawn itself has a particular number of blades of grass. You can't have a lawn, you can't have some patch of lawn that just has an indefinite number of blades of grass. Anything you look at has a determinate character. But your experience of it has a generic character. Even in this room, there look to me to be about 15 people. I'm counting them. But there is a determinate number of people. If I take a photograph of it, the photograph will have the number of people there are in the room, and I can count them. We tend to conflate these two things. That conflation is going on, and Galton is then discovering, no, this is becoming more and more generic, but it's not giving me what I wanted, which was a picture of an idea, of a concept. That's what Galton wanted. That's what he wanted the composites to be. That wasn't what he was getting, and the more he iterated, the clearer that became. Secondly, this brings out another thing, which is that Wittgenstein thinks that experiences themselves are not particulars that have all of the determinacy of a particular itself. Third thing he thinks it helps bring out is that what experience in the first instance, perceptual experience, is not, is a picture. At least a picture in the sense of something like a fully resolved photograph. Now, let's look for a moment at the last picture, the next one you have. Say why Galton thought this was interesting. Galton wanted to say that what we have here is a proof. This is a terrible reproduction, I'm really sorry. It didn't come out very well. But what it is a woodcut. It's a photograph of a woodcut. But the woodcut was made in a particular way. And Galton wanted to argue by means of, I think, a very ingenious but also in some way crazy argument, that it's proof that, as he puts it, a composite photograph is a true composition. So what he did is he took a very nicely made composite photograph of three men. He then made a negative of this, projected the negative onto a block of wood. So he had, as it were, a photograph rather than on paper, on a block of wood. Gave it to a woodcut artist, who then did what he did, which is strike grooves in the wood, make a wood cloth, and then we got a print. And the print, lo and behold, did not look like the composite. It was different from the composite. And it looked like a particular person. And the particular person it looked like was one of the three people of whose pictures the composite was made. But the woodblock artist had never seen that person. On quotation 15, you have Galton's full statement of why this is a proof that the constructed composite is a true combination.